Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK News for Wednesday, December 3rd. I'm Taylor Heckert. Petersburg Public Health officially has COVID-19 vaccines. KFSK reported in September that while the Petersburg Medical Center had COVID vaccines, public health had not yet received them. But public health received a supply in late October and is administering the vaccines. Public health nurse Erin Michael says she has been waiting on the state to get a supply.
Well, they were waiting for the CDC to sign some paperwork that allows the states to start ordering state-supplied vaccine, and that finally happened.
Michael says anyone over the age of 65 can receive a vaccine.
If you're under 65, then it's probably a good idea to check with your medical provider, or you can call here and talk to me. Because it's not blanketly available for everyone.
Individuals who are at high risk for COVID-19 complications can also get the vaccine. The list of conditions that increase someone's risk of getting very sick with COVID is long.
So high risk would include things like having certain medical conditions, heart, lung, kidney issues, asthma, current or former smokers, overweight or obesity, and there's quite a long list.
The CDC has a list of those high-risk conditions on its website. Michael asks that individuals interested in receiving the vaccine from Petersburg Public Health call before showing up. You can contact Petersburg Public Health at 907-772-4611. They are now located at the Work Building on Haugen Drive. 10 years ago, the state of Alaska signed an agreement with British Columbia that sought to give Alaskans a say in the development of mines upstream of Southeast Alaska. Environmental advocates say Governor Mike Dunleavy's administration has walked away from key pillars of that agreement, but state officials say they remain committed to keeping cross-border rivers clean. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports.
It is a boom time for mines in British Columbia, and there are a few reasons for that: the rise of renewable energy and the growing importance of microchips, and of course, President Trump's trade war. Provincial leaders have fast-tracked a variety of resource development projects, including some proposed mines upstream of communities in Southeast Alaska.
The majority of this region is staked with mining claims.
That's Brianna Walker with the group Salmon Beyond Borders, which has campaigned for stricter limits on mines near rivers that cross into Southeast Alaska. 10 years ago, Governor Bill Walker signed an agreement with the Premier of British Columbia that he said would give Alaskans a greater voice in the future of BC mines. It led to the creation of a working group where senior officials in Alaska and BC would meet twice a year to discuss mining and the environment. Brianna Walker says that was a reason for optimism, but she says in the years since, the Dunleavy administration has failed to live up to those commitments. She points to a few issues, including the Dunleavy administration's decision to discontinue water quality monitoring on cross-border rivers in 2021. She'd also like to see meetings between provincial and state leaders include other stakeholders, like Alaska tribes and fishermen. Walker points in particular to pollution at a mine near Hyder at the state's southeastern tip.
Alaskans learned about that pollution through the media. They did not learn about that from the state or from the province of British Columbia. And that's a clear example, in my opinion, of how the state is abdicating the responsibility that they have to Alaskans.
The Dunleavy administration disagrees. State officials point to web pages maintained by the state and by BC detailing the ongoing work between the two governments. And they say the water quality monitoring that ended in 2021 duplicated similar efforts at the federal level. Sam Dapsovich at the State Department of Environmental Conservation says the state has continued to advocate for Alaskans' interests at working group meetings. Just last month, at the most recent cross-border meeting, Dapsovich says the Alaska delegation asked for an update on the cleanup of the Tulsiquitchief mine, which has been polluting the Taku River near Juneau for decades. And in response, the company working on cleanup is planning to hold a public webinar in early December.
And I just want people to understand that our agencies are deeply involved between the two governments advocating for cleanup, and we're using shared science to protect these rivers.
Dapsovich says the state remains committed to ensuring Alaskans' voices aren't lost in the process. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
A group of Southeast Alaska tribes filed a judicial review November 19th over several transboundary mining projects in British Columbia. The judicial review asked the British Columbia Supreme Court to require the province to consult with Alaska tribes on mining projects in the Taku, Stikine, and Unik watersheds. The group, Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission, represents 14 Alaska Native tribes that depend on those rivers and are downstream from the mines. Guy Archibald is the commission's executive director. He says these mining projects are massive and would leave industrial-scale impacts. He says they'd affect watersheds on both sides of the border.
it's not the two different countries any more than it's two different rivers or two different watersheds. It's industrial mining wherever it's at.
The judicial review comes after the Southeast Alaska tribes and environmental groups sent about 30,000 messages to BC lawmakers. They called for a halt to mining projects that affect rivers shared by Alaska and Canada. John Galis is a lawyer in Victoria, BC, representing the tribes.
We're seeking procedural rights, and one of those procedural rights is consultation before before decisions are made that could irreparably harm the substantive rights.
Substantive law establishes what is right and not right. Procedural rights, on the other hand, outlines the rules that everyone must follow. The Tribal Commission wishes to enforce those outlines so that Alaska tribes must be consulted too. Galis says right now, it's more of a one-way flow of information from the province.
I think the tribes are looking for is a seat at that table. Not being sitting over at the kids' table.
British Columbia's Environmental Assessment Office said in an email that, quote, the BC government takes its obligations to consult with First Nations who may be impacted by a proposed project very seriously, including with tribes in the U.S., unquote. But they said that's if there's a credible assertion of Aboriginal rights under the Canadian Constitution with the U.S. tribes. The office says they were unable to provide further comment due to the matter being litigated. Galis says the BC government is not fulfilling that duty. He says they're pushing for an early court date, but BC courts are backed up. He says if delays are significant, they'll call for an injunction. An entangled whale was found dead near Kodiak last month. Scientists believe it was caught in some kind of old fishing gear. As KMXT's Brian Vanwell reports, it's at least the 13th dead humpback whale reported around Kodiak this year.
Humpback whales are a common sight around Kodiak's waterways, often reported breaching and splashing near fishing boats. But sometimes they're reported entangled or dead. Matt Vandale, the Chinook Tribe of Kodiak's Natural Resources Director, was one of the responders in mid-November. He's been training for years to help save entangled whales, but this one likely died about a week before it was reported.
She was about 28 feet long, had a pretty massive, severe entanglement. The entanglement was probably initially a line that she got through her mouth and was not able to free herself, and then started spinning, and she had three or four wraps around her tail stalk.
Vandale and officials from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and Alaska State Parks found the whale stuck to the bottom of the water. She was found with several cuts around her body from the line, some 6 inches deep. Humpbacks can generally hold their breath for up to 45 minutes. Vandale says it likely died from a mix of exhaustion and drowning. The team didn't do a full necropsy. However, he estimated it was just a year old when it died.
It's really frustrating and a bummer that she wasn't spotted while she was still alive, because she would have been a perfect candidate to attempt a disentanglement.
Vandale and the other biologists removed the gear, but it wasn't immediately clear what type of fishing it was used for.
The main thing right now is just trying to figure out what this gear is and where she may have encountered it.
The metal is heavily rusted and tangled, so there's a lot of uncertainty. He brought some fishermen in to try to identify it. The leading guesses are longline gear or some sort of derelict pot. Vandale says there is a silver lining, though.
It did give the Kodiak team excellent opportunity to practice with whale disentanglements, albeit on a dead one, but it was a very good, safe, controlled situation.
He says any entangled marine mammals should be reported to the federal government's hotline or directly to the tribe for them to start working with federal officials. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Vanois.
With major cruise tourism developments on the horizon in the capital city, the city and borough of Juneau is resurrecting a task force to look at whether its current approach to managing tourism is working. At a Juneau Assembly Committee meeting last Monday, members approved the relaunch of the Visitor Industry Task Force and its members. Mayor Beth Weldon says the task force will be crucial in informing the direction the city takes to guide any future growth.
There is some issues that need to be addressed, and our tourism director relies heavily on these recommendations on how to move forward with her job, so that's one of the reasons we're doing this.
Juneau saw another record-breaking cruise ship tourism season this past summer, with more than 1.7 million passengers coming off ships and into town. The task force launches as Gold Belt Incorporated is planning a new $500 million cruise ship port on the backside of Douglas Island. And that plan coincides with another dock development by Huna Totem Corp, an Alaska Native Village Corporation based in Huna. The assembly approved the corporation's plan to build a new cruise ship dock in downtown Juneau this spring. Wilden says she plans for the task force to make big picture recommendations, like a 10-year tourism plan for Juneau. She also wants them to tackle more specific issues, like addressing crowding and congestion in Auk Bay, regulating the whale watching industry, and reducing ship emissions. Assemblymember Ella Adkinson will chair the committee, along with 8 members that Wilden handpicked. Some members are returning from the previous task force, which originally sunsetted in 2020. Wilden says they represent a wide range of perspectives on tourism's future.
I would say this community is no longer deadly against, as a community as a whole, deadly against tourism, nor are we a community that's opening our gates wide for tourism.
The task force has until the end of June to submit its recommendations to the Juneau Assembly. The first ship of the 2026 cruise season is slated to arrive in late April. Juneau Public Market ramped up the holiday shopping season in Alaska's capital city, with hundreds of people buying handmade art, jewelry, clothes, and other goods. Last Saturday, K2O's Alex Solomon talked to vendors from near and far, who say it's one of the most meaningful markets for them.
Centennial Hall in downtown Juneau is bustling with people shopping for holiday gifts from around 175 vendors. One ceramics artist has been selling her kitchen wares at Juneau Public Market for more than 40 years. Betty Bell lives in Milton, Washington, but comes up for the market and to see her daughter and grandkids, all adults now. She's always looked forward to this annual visit.
Oh, it's allowed me to get to know my grandchildren.
Bell says market sales pay for her plane ticket to Juneau. Now that she's 91 years old, she says she sells almost exclusively at this market. But it used to make up about a quarter of her annual sales when she was throwing more clay.
Juneau has embraced me and supported me over the years, and I've kind of become your local out-of-town potter.
That community connection is what brings many artisans back year after year. Vendors pay between $250 and $1,200 for a booth space, and many say they rake in a large portion of their annual sales from this market alone. Carly Thayer's booth, Bering Sea Designs, features sharp lines, soft fur, and colors of the ocean, inspired by the coastal cliffs of Unalaska, where she spent her early years.
I make sea otter fur and metal jewelry. So I've got earrings and bracelets and necklaces, some big pieces like this body piece here that was on the Alaska Fashion Week runway.
She says that selling jewelry at Juneau Public Market makes up about half of her annual sales. But she says it's about more than just the money.
Growing up here, you know everybody, so it's like a family reunion. It's fantastic. We love Public Market.
A woman wearing a pair of earrings she'd purchased from there in the past briefly stopped by the booth.
It's really incredible to see your art walking around.
It's Bailey McAllison's first time as a vendor at the market. He traveled from Fairbanks to sell his earrings and sculptures made of carved walrus ivory. He says this forum, along with social media, is important.
Especially for Native people in communities where job security is hard.
He's been a full-time artist for 6 years. Beyond the income, he says it's allowed him and other Native artists to maintain a way of life.
Where they can stay in their homes rather than moving into the cities and be there for the elders, and you know, so that Upa doesn't lose his grandchildren who pull the nets for him while they're fishing, and just to keep those cultural values strong and held together.
Juneau resident Peter Metcalf started hosting Juneau Public Market in 1983. He says vendors make somewhere between $5,000 and $8,000 on average over the three-day weekend. And he says Black Friday this year was one for the books.
A couple of my longtime vendors said they did more in 2 hours than they'd done in all 3 days of previous events.
He says most makers are based in Alaska, and a little more than half are Juneau locals.
I can't put a figure on it as to how important this is for Juneau's cottage industries, but I know many people who participate, it means a lot to their annual income, and it keeps them in the game.
And more than that, artisans say it's a warm and welcoming space that brings the art community together during the holiday season. In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon.
For KFSK, I'm Taylor Heckert.